Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, once again. To friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording on the 31st of March, 2013. This would be nav briefing number 55, and the title is On a Date with Dumavati. The title is the answer to the question that many of you may have been asking, since you haven't heard from me for a while. So you might have thought, well, I wonder what the nav is up to. We're not in a stall right now. In the past, you've been accustomed to see me drop below the radar during a stall, and you know why that happens. But we're not in a stall right now. So you might have been wondering why you hadn't heard from me through the month of March. And the answer is, I've been on a date with Dumavati. So what I'll tell you in this briefing, if I can, is something about how it feels to encounter this particular Mahavidya, and also what it's done to me over the past month. And you might be reassured to know that I'm still very well, thank you. Sane and sober in mind and body, hale and hearty in spirit and soul. The cats are doing fine. And you may be assured also to know that in this month, something has changed in the GNE. Can you feel it? Something has changed. And during this momentous change, I've relied on you and counted on you, faithful crew members, to hold the course, although you haven't heard from me. You know, I have to put it bluntly and brutally, and yet it is a wonderful thing to say as well. My task, my mission, if you will, is to introduce the term of Gaia Awakening. My mission is to propose the GNE. But I cannot do anything to sustain or maintain your interest and engagement in this project. That is entirely up to you, and I count on you to do so. And I can say now, close to midnight, on this windy winter evening in Andalusia, that the power of the Nawal of the Wisdom Goddess that binds us and bonds us in our hearts has never been stronger. If I were to describe what happened this month, I would use the metaphor of a ship. I would use the nautical metaphor. Remember that the GNE is an experiment with a nautical metaphor. And we find this metaphor to be so productive and so instructive, because it is not only a metaphor, but it is a literal and exact description of the mothership as she makes her way up the stream of the third galactic arm. And what has happened in the month of March is a shift of ballast in the mothership. A shift of ballast. Bear in mind that the shape of the mothership is a lemniscate. The lemniscate is a figure eight with one loop drawn out to a length exceeding the other loop. Visualize a lemniscate with a smaller loop rather in the shape of the body of a violin, the body of a lute, a teardrop shape. That is the compressed part of the lemniscate. And then the upper part of the lemniscate is a long extended loop. And that is the shape of the mothership, the long extended loop corresponding to the foredeck. And the smaller compressed part of the lemniscate, or analemna, as it's also called, corresponding to the rear deck. What has happened in the month of March is that the ballast of the mothership, which previously was carried in the rear deck, in the rear portion of the vessel, shifted forward and shifted into the front part of the vessel. Now you can picture immediately what this implies, can't you? The mothership has taken a deep dive down into the waters of the slipstream of the third galactic limb. Remember that the mothership, the planet Earth, does not float or sail upon the celestial waters of the galactic limb. It is in them. It is immersed. She's immersed in them. And the depth of her immersion changes. I don't know how astronomers have determined this supposed notion, but they do hold this notion. That is to say that the Earth, as it moves through the galactic limb, along with the Sun and the fleet of planets, bobs up and down like a dolphin. Have you heard that description before? Apparently this is so. I don't know where this comes from. I don't know what team of scientists or astrophysicists or astronomers have arrived at this conception. But it does exist. It has been said by the experts that the Earth, as it moves laterally, transversely on its course through the galactic limbs, bobs up and down over long periods of time like a dolphin. And so at moments, the mothership rides higher upon the celestial current. And at other moments, she dives and she plunges and she rides lower. She rides more deeply in the slipstream of the galactic arm. And this is what happened in the month of March in a most dramatic way. Due to the ballast of the mothership shifting toward the forward part of the vessel. Now I speak to you as the navigator, but I am just another observer like you. As I stand on the navigation deck of the planetary vessel. And so, as I said at the beginning of this experiment, let's observe together what we can see, and let's observe the anomalies. As long as human animals remain locked into an archontic frame of perception, everything will appear to be regular, predictable. Everything will appear to have been plotted out. It's impossible for the moon to do anything unusual. It's impossible for the angle of the sun to change at its positioning at the time of the summer solstice or the winter solstice. It's just impossible for any of the stars to move. It's impossible for the pole star to be out of alignment with the pointer stars and the Big Dipper. Impossible, impossible, and impossible, as long as you remain within the archonic framework. Because within the archonic framework, and that is the framework in which astronomers, astrologers, astrophysicists, and scientists operate, you will only see what you expect to see, and you will only see what corresponds to the model that you have made of the cosmos, but you will not see the actual living activity of the cosmos. And so one of the premises of the GNE, as you know, and you've tested it many, many times, you've tested it, I've tested it, we've tested it together. One of the premises is that we can observe anomalies that do not conform to the model of how the universe should behave, of how the planet Earth should behave and the sun and moon should act. And so during this month of March 2013, you may have made some observations of this kind, that is to say, the observations of anomalies that are veracious, they are right there in front of your eyes, and yet they cannot be explained according to the scientific paradigm of the way the world works. And I can attest to an anomaly, which I have also verified with a second observer. And that is that during the course of this month, as the moon approached its full phase, and the full moon was, I believe, on the 27th of March, that's right, the new moon that commenced the Swan-Deva shift occurred on the 12th, on the 11th actually, so the first day of the Swan-Deva shift, which we are still in, was the 12th of March, and then the full moon fell on the 27th. And so I can say that I detected the moon reaching a height in the sky that was totally astounding. A height in the sky. The moon was so high, and in fact, the sun itself appears to be, from my viewpoint and from my locale, far higher toward the zenith than where it would actually be at this time. I have a pole, a vertical pole erected out in front of my house, and I've been using the shadow as a kind of sundial. You know how this can be done. So I marked the shadow of the sun across this pole at the noon hour, that is when the sun crosses the meridian, on the 21st of December, and that would be the moment that generates the longest shadow line. You can see why. The sun is low in the sky compared to its positions at other times in the year. And so the shadow that it casts by the pole is the longest shadow. The day of the winter solstice gives you the longest shadow of the year. And subsequently after that, you see the shadow growing shorter and shorter due to the sun being higher and higher. Well, of course, this is natural, this is normal, this is all explicable. But what I find to be anomalous is that even before the moment of the spring equinox, which is only halfway to the summer solstice when the sun reaches its highest point in the sky, even at that halfway moment, March 21st, the sun appears to be much higher than it ought to be. Now, this again is one of these really baffling impressions. I suppose that if I had a team of scientists here, if I called them over to my house and set them to make measurements of what was going on, they would do their stuff, they would consult their instruments, they would do their math, and they would come back to me shaking their heads and saying, "Oh, no, 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 everything is just exactly as it should be. This is the angle that the sun should be. And there is no anomaly, there is no variation in the celestial mechanics," which, as you know, is an archonic expression. But I have to tell you, regardless of whether the operations of the sun and earth fit the model of celestial mechanics, in my perception, something is strange. Being a human animal attuned to the real life of this planet, not just in a token expression that you recognize that nature is alive, but being attuned and interactive with her life cycles, is sort of like being one of those animals that was on the Indonesian island before the tsunami hit. There were all the people on the island going about doing their business, buying and selling things, driving around on their cars and scooters. And at a certain moment, most of the animals of the island, even the domestic animals and the cows, headed for the hills. Why? Because they were not living in the model of the predictable, predetermined reality. They were living in interactivity with actual reality. And they knew what was coming and they felt it. So I'm sort of like one of those animals, I guess, as you are as well, all of you. I know how many of you have testified to this experience over the last 2 years. I've been watching the sun all my life, and I've never seen it so high, and it shouldn't look as if it is that high at this time of the year, nor should the moon, which is so high, which was so high during the days approaching its full phase, that I thought it was going to be vertically right over the top of my house, and it almost was. Well, this is impossible. Because at the moment of the full moon, although the moon was at its extreme degree of declination above the ecliptic, it was even more. There was a factor that could not be explained by the measurable and astronomical data. Of course, people will dismiss that, and they may do so. Doesn't bother me in the least. People will say, it's totally subjective and you're exaggerating. But the final thing I'll say about this is that I had the feeling, why did I have this feeling? Where did this come from? I had the feeling, and I said to Kundry, the ballast has shifted. forward. The ballast of the mothership has shifted forward, and what's happening? Well, what does that mean? Well, it means that she takes a plunge into the southern regions. And that being the case, it would produce the anomaly of the sun and moon appearing in a higher declination than they actually are appearing. But the point is, and science is never going to get this point, unless the scientists go into the Nahual a few times, point is that the appearances are real. The appearances are just as real as what the model says the Earth should be doing. And so, I say to you, I ask you to consider with me that the mothership is taking a deep, deep plunge down into the river of the galactic arm. And another confirmation of this, if you will, we do look for these scientific confirmations, don't we? You can call them confirmations, call them correlations. Another confirmation of this is that for some time now, astronomers and people working in the deep space dimension, where events are unfolding around the Earth, in the upper atmosphere, in the ionosphere and beyond, these scientists are reporting that there are massive vertical discharges of lightning in the upper ionosphere. Mega lightning, vertical discharges, sometimes V-shaped, vertical discharges of lightning in the upper atmosphere. Remember that the atmosphere, both the breathable atmosphere and the troposphere and the ionosphere and so forth beyond, are metaphorically the sails of the mothership. She is a steam sailor. And the sails are the atmosphere. And so she has high voltage, high range discharges of lightning in her sails. Why? Because she's deeper into the galactic stream, into the streaming of the galactic limb. She's deeper down, therefore there is, as it were, more wind in her sails. And more wind means more friction in the process of electrical conduction through space. And more friction means thunderbolts and discharges of lightning. So something has happened on this journey we are undertaking. Something has happened in my life journey as well during this period of time. You know, the last thing I remember before I could find the space to talk to you was standing under the hinge of the second Matangi shift. That would have been on the 6th of March, and looking up at that hinge and taking in the instruction of the moment corresponding to that phenomenon, the last seventh to the last day of the lunar shift. At that moment, I was summarizing in my mind, I was doing what a sorcerer calls an inventory. Sorcerers do inventories, as you know. And I was doing an inventory of the instructions of Matangi. And I was pretty overwhelmed by the extent of her instruction and by the brilliance and simplicity of the strategies that she presents, because she is a master strategist. When standing in the flux of Matangi's instruction is a thrilling experience. And a great part of the thrill is being able just to hold the thrill. It's thrilling to hold the thrill, isn't it? And so there's any number of strategies or tactics or weapons Matangi is providing now, such as the weapon of arrogation. And these realizations come to mind, and they filter down into corporeal reality at the moment when the bands of the Calico Warrior Party are forming. Now, before I get into some specific material of this briefing, or as a way to lead into it, I want to say something about the Calico Warrior Party. Be clear that I am not inventing the Calico Warrior Party. I'm just describing it. I'm providing the description. Remember that the role of the Nahual is to steady the approach to the unknown and to define syntax. So I'm simply defining the syntax of an event that is happening on this planet right now due to the response, the visceral response of those human animals who are sensing the urgency of Sophia's correction. It is happening. I am not calling forth the Calico Warriors. The Calico Warriors are calling themselves forth. What is the purpose of defining the Calico War Party in the way that I have done? The purpose of it is really important because it is a strategic tool. It's a strategic description. There is so much to be done in correction, in personal and social realities, so much to be done to turn around the evil and deceit of this world and bring her experiment back to its original terms. There is so much to be done that it is imperative that every single one of you knows exactly where you stand in the ranks. Now, in this place, I can, in this context, I can freely juxtapose the nautical metaphor and the description of the Calico War Party. Why? Well, look at a boat. Look at one of these reconstructed four masters, as they're called, these great square-rigged four masters that they've reconstructed. Or go look at this film, Master and Commander, with Russell Crowe. Go look at the scenes that show how a sailing vessel of that kind and that time was operated. And what do you find? You find that every single person on that vessel had a particular task to do. And they had to do it at the exact moment when it was needed and in coordination with the other sailors, those who were in the ringing, those who were up at the crow's nest, those who were holding in the lines, those who were below, doing whatever they had to do in their tasks below deck, those on the navigation deck. This is exactly how it is with the Kalika War Party. There is going to be so much to do. It is going to hit like a massive wave when the correction breaks, that every single one of you needs to know your place in the ranks. It's not a hierarchical ranking, my friends. It is a functional ranking, simply functional. That's all. If you handle the mainsail, if you handle the ropes or the rudder, those are all activities defined by your capacity and the talent that you display to be on this journey. It's your talent, and your passion and your desire that fuse together and meld and take you to the position that you hold in these ranks. Sophia herself calls us into these ranks. She calls us to the Kalika War Party. As you know, I've made a tentative sketch of the formation of these ranks, and you picture it in a number of V formations with the vertex of the V upwards. So you know that the avant-garde or front line of the Kalika War Party consists of the three V's. Matangi on the right flank, that consists entirely of women. Central is the wedge or V of Kalika male warriors, those who have Kali as their guardian. And on the left flank, the motley crew of men and women in the rank of Kukula. So you have those three inverted V's. Picture them. They stand at the borderline of the battleground of Kurukshetra. And in front of them, on the ground of the battle itself, is Vivi herself. So picture that. Vivi herself in front of that triple formation. And there was Vivi, I might add, in the field of Kurukshetra, is the originator. Now, dropping back into the ranks, picture the two ranks that stand behind the avant-garde. There is a space between the Matangi and Kali contingents. And in that space are those warriors who are guided and directed by Bhairavi. There's also a space between Kurukula and the Kali contingent central. And in that space stand those Kalikas, male and female, who are under the guidance and direction of Shodashi. Now drop back one more level to the space between those two inverted V's. I'll provide a sketch of this. And there is the unique band of Kalika warriors who hold the balance of this battle and hold the balance of forces within all the ranks of the war party. And those are the unique people who stand under the guidance and directions of Vishvamata. Now draw a kind of a line, because there are front rank and rear rank participants in the war party. Now there is no hierarchy here. As I said, there's no level of evaluation that makes the front rank more important than the rear rank. all the ranks are equally important. Just like on a four-masted sailing vessel, someone hanging in the ropes, making sure that a knot is tight, some sailor, man or woman, hanging up there in the rigging, checking the rigging, taking care of one knot in the rigging is just as important as the navigator. Because if that knot goes, if that knot slips or fails to do its function, no matter how well the navigator is doing his job, the ship will not sail to its destination and it will not have safe passage. The most minute task is as important as the overall activities that fall to the members of the front ranks. And so as we fall back into the second level of rank, the tasks are very specific. Very, very specific. So for now, there is just a line. I don't think it's possible to describe the formation of the remaining ranks, the remaining V formations or wedges. It may not be possible to define them or describe them, a better word, to describe them clearly until a year from now. But I can tell you some things about what I see there, and I want to talk in the next nav briefing on the battle for the narrative about the role of certain people, about the role of certain human animals in the Kalika warrior party, and that would be the black animals, the black people, brothers and sisters of dark skin. And I can tell you right now, as a preview, that every single ethnic group on this planet has a particular role to play in Sophia's correction. Race is a great part of the problem on this planet, but race is also a great part of the solution. Isn't that good news? Imagine, on this troubled, tormented planet, which has been driven to insanity by the master race ideology of the Zadokim, imagine that race could be part of the solution. And it is. And I assure you, the tactical understanding of that proposition is coming over the horizon really fast. And as it does, one of the enormous factors of correction that falls into place is the role of the people of black and dark skin. And that role is tremendous. Also, I would add, as far as Europe goes, all of the ethnic cultures of Europe have their place in the process of correction. But most critical of them all is the Teutonic people, the Germans. That is the most critical, historically and socially speaking. Because it is the Teutonic people and the Germans who are noble, noble race of pagan and heroic substance have been betrayed and massacred by the enemies of humanity in a way that is so heartbreaking, cruel, and deceitful that it is difficult to even speak of it. I'm talking to you now in the mood of Swan Deva, during the shift of Swan Deva. And I ask you to recall that Swan Deva is unique among all of the Gayan Dakinis, and that she is the Dakini who instructs through the medium of sweeping narratives and great plots and stories. And it is these great plots and stories that allow ethnic cultures to identify themselves, to find their own identity. They find their identity through the story of their culture, just like an individual finds his or her identity through the story of his or her family. So there are these ethnic families, the families of humanity, all the ethnic families, the Swedish, the Finnish, the Italian, the German, the Portuguese, the Spanish, all these ethnic families are involved in the orchestrations of Swan Deva. And what has happened to the human race as a whole is that these ethnic families who take their identity from the places where they live and through the stories that come from their indigenous traditions have been suppressed and have not been allowed to claim their true identities and have not been allowed to celebrate the qualities of their own indigenous culture. And that suppression is part of the great deceit and the great lie unfolding on this planet that is breaking due to the power of correction. The power of correction breaks this lie. It breaks this lie and it breaks open the freedom of each of these ethnic families to recognize and re-own the genius of its own race. And this is the glory of this experiment. And it is all orchestrated by Swan Deva. Can you imagine the power and scope of this wisdom goddess? Now, in speaking of the specific strategies and tasks allotted to each of the V-shaped contingents in the Kalika War Party, let me say a little bit about the second tier. That is to say, Shodashi on the left, Bhairavi on the right, standing behind the three warrior goddesses in the front line. What can I say at this point about the functions, tasks, and strategies and duties of these two groups? Some of you to whom I'm speaking now may be in the party of Shodashi. How would you know? The party of Shodashi primarily consists of a massive number of human animals who are already here. I'm not creating these parties. I'm not calling forth these parties. Sophia is calling forth these parties. I'm simply giving you the description of these parties. Do you understand? And this description is so important because when you know which party you are in, you know where to focus and direct your talents. Those in the party of Shodashi are the aesthetic rebels of this planet. They are the artists in every sphere of art, whether it be theatrical, graphic, photographic, painting, music. in any form of art that is used as a tool and weapon for social revolution, that is the party of Shodashi. And there is room in this party for countless, countless warriors who are already assembling, who are already on the line, who already feel the call to war against the enemies of humanity. Now, turn your gaze over to the right. There is the party or contingent of Bhairavi. These are ferocious warriors who are dedicated to the use of anger and rage for social change and to clear the atmosphere of hypocrisy, lies, and obtusity. I've spoken of Bhairavi, and I've said that she does not instruct through any verbal syntax. Remember that? Bhairavi does not use verbal syntax, except that she encourages the articulation of anger, sacred anger, elucidated rage. These are the qualities of the warriors of Bhairavi. Now, if you listen to my reading of the two essays I wrote on planetary tantra, the tantric conversion, part one, part two, you'll recall that in the end of part two, if you're looking at the text on site at the same time that you're listening to me, hold on, I'll pull it up. If you're looking at the text on site, you'll see that when you come to the end of the tantric conversion part two, you'll see that I included there a section of the star-based zodiac, constellation of the twins, the crab, and the lion with just the head of the virgin. And this is actually a scan of the model, the RimSight model that I had on hand back then in 2008, when I just sat down and without thinking about it and without elaborating and without planning and without using any male mind manipulations and male mind suppositions and programming and self-programming and metaprogramming, I just sketched these correlations. I just wrote them down like that. And in that spontaneity, you'll see right there the evidence that I wrote Dumavati. You see that? Dumavati, associated with the constellation of the crab. And, of course, Vajravarahi, or Vajrayogini, being the principal Gayan Dakini associated with the crab. And Bhairavi with the lion. And what I saw at the time that I made those spontaneous correlations in the process of unzipping the zip file of the term of Gaia Awakening, I saw immediately, oh, here's one of those anomalies, here's one of those irregularities, here's one of those chaotic, charming chaotic features of planetary tantra. Is that it doesn't all fit into this neat mold. It's fluid. It's complex. It has intriguing variations. And I saw, wow, look at that. That Dumavati doesn't fit anywhere. She's the floater. They call her the sweeper. She is Our Lady of Smoke. She has a characteristic in common with Matangi. They both have the crow as their totem animal. The crow. The crow, the black crow, the raven. Poe's raven, the Nevermore raven, accompanies Dumati. Because when you have a date with Dumati, you look at what is nevermore. What is never to be. Evermore. And that's what I've been looking at for the past month or so. I didn't realize that Dumavati was sitting on my doorstep. That's where she sits, by the way. She sits on the sill. On the windowsill, or on the sill of the open door. Or maybe she sits at the gate, the gateway. So you have to walk around her to come in or out. Dumavati, the widow. Now, initially, when I made this sketch of correlations of the Shakti cluster to the zodiacal constellations, I had a sense that Dumavati was in some way connected with Vajrayogini, crab, or with Bhairavi, lion. Well, I didn't see exactly how. I could see that she was a loose character, you know, a loose canon, if you will, and yet in some way had a particular affinity with those two Dakinis, and with that point of juncture, where the constellation of the lion and the crab verge on each other, as they actually do. And I tried to show that by illustrating the left paw of the lion reaching out toward the composite stars in the constellation of the crab, which, by the way, is a very dim and amorphous constellation. Now, today, at some considerable reach of time since I made those correlations, going on what, 4.5 years, I can specify those affinities. First place, one that I already understood at that time, concerns the matter of grief. Grief. Dumavati brings grief. She is grief. She's the smoke and scent of grief. She's the very aroma of grief. And I thought, well, that must be associated with Bhairavi, because Bhairavi is absolutely terrible and just devastates and levels everything to the ground. And so where there is the destruction of Bhairavi, grief is certainly due to follow. So grief hangs around the domain of Bhairavi. Dumavati haunts the domain of Bhairavi. I could see that. This is really relevant intel when it comes to those in the Kalika War Party who stand under the guidance and direction of Bhairavi. Just as I said, those in the Shodashi band are the aesthetic rebels who use beauty as a weapon. Those in the ranks of Bhairavi give grief. They give grief. You see, grief is something you can get. And I've got a lot of it in the last month. I've had a lot of grief. I haven't been able to speak. I have been so deep in grief. But you can also give grief. You know the expression, I'm going to give you some grief. And that is what the warriors in the band of Bhairavi do, because they have, as it were, a special dispensation from Dumavati. They have a special skill to really, really give people grief. And that means to give people who are complicit with the enemies of humanity and who are perpetrating as dupes or conscious accessories the triple agenda of division, deceit, and domination, to give them some really, really astounding grief. and to make them really miserable. To make people miserable is something that needs to be done. To break the complacency and obtusity into which human animals have become embedded now by their complicity in the agenda of social evil. The agendas of social evil on this planet, which are operating through authorities and chains of authorities and through bureaucrats and through people who make trouble and hassle the lives of other people, those are the human animals who are going to see some real grief coming their way. And that grief is going to be good for them. Grief is good medicine. I have to say, grief is good medicine. It's hard to take, but it's good medicine. And it's good medicine to be doled out to these miserable, pathetic dupes and accessories in this game of insanity that is spoiling the divine experiment on this planet and ruining the fun. So anybody who stands in my presence and who stands in my face and tries to ruin my fun gets a dose of grief from me. And I'm not even in the Bhairavi band. That is their dedication, is to give people grief. It's like giving them a medicine. It's like ayahuasca gives you grief. And people need to puke their guts out, and they need to puke out the rotten convictions by which they live. And then they can die on the spot from that purge, or they can pick themselves up and recreate their life in the true beauty of this experiment. And there is something that Kalika warriors say in their minds, and they can say it aloud, and they say in their minds in social situations which are difficult. It's like a war cry. It's like those fantastic cries and grimaces and that threat display that you see in the war dance of the Maori. And what they say is, do not fuck with my dream. And so this is the spirit and the feel of those in the Bhairavi contingent of the Kalika warrior party. And I would say that everyone who comes into that party dedicated to Bhairavi and working under her guidance and instruction finds an intimate relation to Dumavati as well. So there are many of you out there who are due for a date with Dumavati, like the one that I am just concluding. You know, Dumavati is very similar to a gitana or a gypsy woman. Of course, gypsies and all outcasts, especially female outcasts of society, are Matangi women and belong under the protection of Matangi. But there's a strong affinity between our beloved Matangi and Dumavati. So Dumavati also has that gypsy flair. She has the dark, dangerous look of a gitana, like you see sometimes here in Andalusia. Don't see them much around the area where I live, around the Rhondda Valley and so forth. More over towards Sevilla or down toward Cadiz. I'll tell you what these gitanas look like. They're generally thin. Generally thin. Fleshy, but thin and hard. They have mean bodies. They can be very dark. I saw a gitana in Sevilla who was as dark as women that I've seen in southern India. Not too long ago, I saw a gypsy girl here in the local village. And I knew immediately she was a gypsy girl, not only because she had those cheekbones and that dark, menacing allure, you know, fatal attraction is operating here, folks, with these babes. But I also saw it in the way she was dressed. Do you know how gitanas dress in Andalusia? They dress with long dresses that come all the way down to their ankles. You don't see gitanas in any of this skanky MTV kind of attire that so many young women today are inspired to take on, to dress themselves in, you know, dressing up like hoes. You don't see that with gitanas. No. I saw one, she had on a blouse. You could see it was not low cut. It was a blouse. They don't display themselves flagrantly. It was a blouse, a long sleeve blouse. And she had a very long dress, a dark dress that went all the way down to her ankles. And she wore those shoes that are kind of like granny shoes, you know? They tie up quite high on the ankle. And she's walking through the street, trudging through the street. Every time she walked, the dress moved like a wave. This is how a gitana looks in the streets of Andalusia. And this is how Dumavadi looks to me. How she looked when she showed up for our first date. Now, what can I tell you about what's been happening through this encounter? You know, I've never had this encounter before. I've never had the woman of smoke lingering on my doorstep. There's not much I can tell you, really, except that I learned something about her. She's mysterious. She's deep. She's enigmatic. But I learned that she has an affinity through grief with Bhairavi, but likewise she has an affinity with Vajrayogini or Tantra Mother, as I originally intuited, remember? As I originally intuited. And now I can say something about that affinity. Let's recall that our precious and sublime Tantra Mother has a supreme instruction, doesn't she? What is the supreme, single and supreme instruction of Tantra Mother? Release from pretending. So we know that she uses her blade, which is a flaying blade. She has a flaying blade, such as the Tibetans use to flay the skin off animals. And she uses this flaying blade to liberate you from pretending. I've written a lot about this. I have a lot to say about this because the lesson of Tantra Mother mother was key in my experience with Emma and in my release from that experience. And I can truly say that the instruction of Tantra Mother in that regard saved my sorry ass and saved my life. Saved my life. How many true and genuine and passionate human animals have gone under into insanity or despair for lack of that instruction, especially when it concerns the trials and betrayals of the romantic path. So what is the affinity? Dumavati has an instruction concerning pretending that is complementary to that of Tantra Mother. But it is quite different at the same time. I can't really elaborate on this right now, and I don't know if I will be able to in the future. I'll just have to let it out as it comes up, if it does. What I can tell you is that, well, let me put it this way. I've been known to say that I like to keep my pretenses right out in the open. Have you ever heard me say that? I like to keep my pretenses right out in the open. It saves a lot of time, folks. You could meet a teacher, you could meet a master, a guru, you could meet some charismatic, brilliant person, you could meet an artist or an actor, and you could get really involved with them, as you are involved with me, in a most intimate manner, aren't you? And you could go on for years before you realized the pretenses of that particular individual. Well, I'm not going to put you through that kind of crap. I'll let you know my pretenses right from the get-go. I like to keep my pretenses right out in the open. But my style, if you will, my habit, my chosen habit of doing that, it's going to be of no benefit if you don't know what I mean by pretense. Now, Dumavati knows all about pretense. And part of the grief that she brings is an offering she makes to take away your pretenses. Now, this is an area that gets into a really profound instruction about the human ego and what I will call the phenomenon of self-perception. I don't want to make it complicated, because it's not complicated. And yet, the utter simplicity of this instruction is so staggering that I have to get on the other side of it to get it out to you in the way it's been delivered to me. And I'm still doing that right now. I'm still doing that. Folks, friends, crew, I'm just getting around this encounter with Dumavati. But let me say this that may be helpful in concluding this briefing. How can you understand what I mean by the word pretense? This is something different from the acts of pretending that fall under the domain of Tantra Mother. Pretense is, in the definition that I use, identical with the laksana of the Buddhist teaching. And laksana is a word in Sanskrit which means posture or pretense. And this teaching is contained in one of the three unique, special and unique transmission instructions of Buddhism, and that is the Diamond Sutra. And the Diamond Sutra is a teaching about the lakshanas, or the postures or pretenses. So, what is the meaning of pretense in the sense of the Diamond Sutra? It means whatever you think about yourself. It doesn't mean what you think you might be. For instance, you could say, oh, she has the pretense of being a great pianist, or he has the pretense of being a great father or a great lover, or she has the pretense of being an accomplished artist, you know. And generally, in the ordinary conception of this term, pretense, we assume that a pretense is a falsely assumed idea of yourself. I'm telling you that any idea of yourself is a pretense. Such is the instruction of the Diamond Sutra. So, my pretenses are all my ideas of myself. All the facets of my self-reflection and my self-definition, those are my pretenses. And whether they're true or not doesn't matter. You know, am I like, you know, a great tantrika, or am I, you know, is that a pretense? In the sense that it's something that I pretend to be but I'm not? Or is it what I actually am? It doesn't matter. In either case, it's a pretense. Now, the teaching of Dhammavati is a teaching, an instruction that is excruciating to the degree of the best sex you ever had. And just like the best sex, it strips you down to a naked melt of emotion. And in this naked melt of emotion, which is the grief she pours on you, so that she can take from you those pretenses that you don't need anymore, those pretenses that don't work. See, there's nothing wrong with having pretenses. You can't live with having pretenses. Are you a loving mother, loyal to your children? And even if you really are, that is a pretense. There's nothing wrong. There's no judgment on pretenses. But some pretenses you do better without. Those that you retain, be transparent about them. Keep them out in the open. Let people who meet you know exactly what you think of yourself. It'll save a lot of time. It really will. And besides that, it's honest. Be honest about what you think about yourself. Let people see it. Nothing to fear. They can take what they like and leave the rest, you know? But some pretenses have to go. And what I've been shown in this last month is just exactly that. And this is a very heavy thing. This is a heavy what I've been going through. It's what I call a life and death experience. Not a life or death experience, but it's a life and death experience. And there are particular pretenses, I won't go into the gruesome details, carried by John Lash, that have to go. And in facing that, I face the nevermore of Poe's Raven. That is to say, I shall never more hold those pretenses. Dhumavati provides a service, if you will. I know that's not a tantric word, but I have to use it in this case. It's like the service of the people who come and take away your rubbish. It's like the service of Matangi, who takes away leftovers. Leftovers, you know, are the offerings to Matangi. How wonderful is that? But the service of Dhumavati is this impeccable clearing of your pretenses so that you're only left with the ones that are of the highest merit. I wish I could be more specific in what I'm talking about, but quite honestly, I don't want to disclose certain things too personal at this moment because it's extremely raw for me and I'm still in it. But you know, I have no aversion to personal disclosure. You know that. But in this case, I'm walking softly. I should probably follow up this briefing with a second on the same theme and saying more, if I can and whatever I can, regarding my date with Dhumavati. So, on that note, I leave it with you for now.